Thank you. I think I might start this evening by talking a little bit about those who are running our country, the present administration. And I know that there are a lot of rumors going around about certain feelings that exist in the administration as far as black people are concerned. But I'd like to make one thing crystal clear, if I might use that phrase. A number of people think that our president, Mr. Nixon, hates black people. I don't believe that. In fact, I believe that Mr. Nixon thinks that every family in this country should own one. You know, there's a lot of talk about the appointments that our president is making, and most of it stems around the idea and the fact that charges are made that these people are not qualified for the positions which he is appointing them. But I think that he could appoint one person without any serious objections, because we know that he's well qualified. He could appoint his cousin, for instance, to head the Health, Education, and Welfare Department. We all know that he's healthy, he's educated, and he most certainly is on welfare. He could appoint my dog to the Supreme Court. He's found a number of other dogs and attempted to put them on the Supreme Court. I was a little bit disturbed the other day. I read a newspaper article that said that our vice president had an IQ of 135, which is getting close to a genius. And it sort of upset me. I couldn't sleep the whole night. So I called the Washington Post the next morning, and the editor readily assured me that there had been hundreds of other calls and that there had been a typographical error, that somebody left a decimal point out. The only problem with these political jokes is that sometime they get elected president and vice president of the United States. But I have one I would like to share with you. I was standing at the airport the other day on my way. I had just come in, got off of a plane, was standing out there waiting for a taxi cab, and a big empty limousine drove up, and our vice president got out. Takes a little time on that one. But as I was landing that particular day, the stewardess said that we're now approaching a national airport. This is the home of our nation's capital, the home of the White House and President Nixon, the home of Congress, both the Senate and the House, and the home of the Supreme Court. She said that according to the FAA regulations, that we must put our seat trays up, put our seat backs in an upright position, fasten our safety belts, and turn our watches back 100 years. I feel indeed an honor and a privilege to have been asked to address you this evening. When I first received the invitation to speak on black political power, I hesitated for fear that I was not competent enough to address that subject. I know that there are many, many other persons in the field of politics who are far better equipped to deal with this matter than I. But after some thought, I decided to accept the challenge and decided that perhaps I could seek to stimulate, to provoke, and to inform you, even with the limited ability, knowledge, and capacity that I have. I decided that I must make a serious attempt to discuss the problems and issues facing us in the 70s and try to relate the solutions to the new black political thrust. In my opinion, the time has come for black people to stop playing political games and get themselves together. The time has also come for the millions of Americans who are considered to be the have-nots to recognize their common concerns as well as their common enemies. The time has come for the powerless and the oppressed to stop warring against each other and devise a strategy for launching an assault on those who keep us all oppressed. All who are victimized by the system must stop seeing each victimized group as rivals and must realize that we are all on the same side, and that side is humanity. The name of the game is not black issues or women's issues or poverty issues or ecology issues or peace issues, but human issues. And unless we unite to confront the powerful ruling classes, we will always be the have-nots, the oppressed, the victimized. I envision a day of liberation for the poor and the black and the Chicano, the women, the young, the Indian, as that day immediately following the evening when all of these groups say in one loud, clear voice that's united, we will no longer tolerate exploitation of any sort. Now, such a coalition implies that each group will bring some clout and some muscle. And in order to have clout and muscle, one must be effectively organized and have a sense of purpose and direction. This brings me to the discussion of black political power. It's becoming increasingly apparent that one of the basic weaknesses in the structure of black America is its political disunity. Unless we develop a black political power base that can effectively deal with our problems, we will have nothing to offer a coalition with the women and the young and the Chicanos. Unless we develop a black power base and unite with other powerless interests, there's no hope, absolutely no hope, of us ever attaining our rights of citizenship. On the local level, we find too many black elected officials engaged in divisive guerrilla-type activities, which can only impede the progress of our people. There's much talk about the rivalry and disagreement among black local officials, but black communities cannot afford the luxury of political disunity. The stakes are too high. The potential for meaningful progress is too great. It is inconceivable that in this day and age, some black ward leaders and councilmen and representatives would become the pawns of outside forces who are determined to divide us. For 50 years, our people have dreamed of and prayed for the day when black political unity would provide the machinery for achieving a just share of the political, economical, and social pie. The confusion and frustration presently existing in some communities tend to divert our energy and effectiveness in our effort to combat sinister forces that would exploit our people. Our cause is too great to let personal differences and vanity sidetrack it. Our lack of planning, lack of commitment, and intra-party bickering pose a threat to our advancement as a people. Now, we're on the threshold of the reality of our dream. Nothing or no one should be permitted to foster disunity in our drive for equality. It has taken many years of struggle and sacrifice, mistakes, defeats, and victories to arrive at this point in time. Any force from within or from without our communities which threatens our political unity also threatens our social and economic stability. And I contend that if the present black elected officials are not mature enough to grasp this basic view, then the black electorate should elect black people who can. If we are to maximize our political strength, irresponsible, self-serving, self-defeating rhetoric must stop. Black politicians must become less radical in their statements and more radical on the issues. Some black politicians must quit offering themselves to the highest white bidder and must stop promising to deliver the black community. That concept is passé. The black ghettos of this country are not the Cimarron Trail, and its inhabitants are not cattle to be herded from their homes to the polls for slaughter. Talk about white money buying black communities is precisely talk, for black communities are no longer for sale. This is no time for us to be playing games. It's no time for us to be encouraging white investments and deceiving them into thinking that they can control the areas where we live. Black people must raise their own money in black neighborhoods and from black people. Political independence is predicated on financial independence, and it must be made crystal clear that a working relationship can be established with white political interests without blacks becoming totally enslaved to those interests. Black politicians who still idolize the great white father must be politically exterminated and socially and economically ostracized. We've got to remember that we still have some very powerful enemies, and that they're still determined to keep us fighting each other so that we will not have time to fight those enemies. It's not by accident that the press distorts and blows out of proportion any disagreement among black leaders. It's not accidental that one black leader is pitted against another, but it would be tragic if we fall into their trap. There are too many crucial problems confronting us for any black elected official to go on a political ego trip. Too many of our people are ill-housed and ill-fed. Our children are kept by the public schools for 12 years and turned out with 6 years of education. Black college graduates are earning $3,000 a year less than white college graduates. They're earning $1,000 a year less than white high school graduates, and amazingly as it seems, they're earning $300 a year less than white high school dropouts. The rate of unemployment for our youth in urban areas is a staggering 42%, and crime is running rampant in our neighborhoods. With this kind of crisis facing us in black America, it should dictate that we cannot afford to engage in idle debate about which black leader is the most powerful. Locally elected officials, in my opinion, must stop bragging that they have secured additional street lighting for their constituents, or that the trash in their ward or in their area is picked up twice a week. These are not major political accomplishments. These are the rights of citizens, regardless of which political party they belong to. You don't have to belong to the Republican Party or the Democratic Party to be entitled to certain city services. Even people in jail are entitled to decent housing and are entitled to sanitary conditions. What black elected officials had better be concerned about is not the new highway in the neighborhood, but who will determine if, when, and where that highway will be built? We must be concerned not so much with how much cities and states are going to spend, but how those taxes are going to be spent and who's going to make those decisions. I think that it's time for our locally elected officials to sit down and decide on some very hard facts of life. I think they've got to decide whether or not they're going to continue playing the same old game of promises, or if they're going to deliver on some of the commitments that they have made. Blacks should not be particularly interested, in my opinion, in who the white candidate for public office is going to be. I contend that the slogan at the Gary Convention was quite accurate and quite proper when they said that our slogan is unity without uniformity. We can be united on a program for the advancement of our people without all agreeing on the same candidate. If more than one candidate agrees to a program developed by black people, for black people, then it really makes no difference which of those candidates is elected. I think that we must develop the same degree of political sophistication that others have. If there are 10 candidates seeking the presidency, all 10 may be supported by elements in the Jewish community. But you can bet your last dollar that not one of them will be supported by anybody in the Jewish community who is not committed to the idea of an independent state of Israel, or who is not committed to the idea of selling planes to Tel Aviv. Now, I say that we should adopt that same kind of political philosophy. An agenda of black needs must be developed at this local level, and it must be presented to all who are seeking public office. And those candidates who publicly and in advance of the election endorse that agenda are worthy of our support. I personally could care less how many black babies a candidate kisses or how many black cocktail lounges he frequents. I say that we've got to get our game together. And our title, The Development of Black Political Power of the 70s, indicates that somewhere along the line, some of us are attempting to get this game together. Our title, The Development of Black Political Power, assumes one thing and it implies another. It clearly assumes that there is a developing black political power, and it definitely implies that it will be operative in the 70s. I suggest that both the assumption and the implication are accurate. On a national level, blacks are in the stage of developing a plan of single purpose to obtain through the exercise of black political power the reality of economic, social, and political manhood. If we are to accept nothing less than meaningful participation at the center of power, then we as elected black officials must be united. This is our objective. Full participation in the country's decision-making process must be the basis for our unity, and it must be our purpose to achieve this goal now. We must seek not only for the present, but must develop and demand for the future the enforcement of long-range plans. For it has to be our positive assumption that the achievement of our goals are essential for the maintenance of an orderly American society. No longer can black America silently accept the present degenerate caliber of white leadership. No longer can we passively tolerate the immorality and the insanity that permeates our country. Our obligation is a challenging one. We must assume the mantle of leadership and redirect this nation back to the path of moral, humane consciousness. We must become the spearhead in the movement to eradicate racism in private and public institutions. We must become the vanguard in the struggle to provide every man with a decent living and a decent home. Every person must be afforded fair and impartial justice. Every business must be guaranteed a fair share of the public funds. And every community must have full participation in determining how tax dollars are to be spent. These goals are attainable. They are attainable now if we unite and dispel our fears, frustrations, and the indoctrinations that we have been the victims of for too many years. Who convinced us that we must subjugate the interests of black people for the interests of the nation? We're the only group of people in this country who are so concerned and so interwoven with the struggle to protect the interests of other groups that we have neglected our own. If our politics of the 70s is to be productive and meaningful, then it must be consistent with the rules of the game. If we are to play the political game, then we must learn those rules. Now, rule number one says that we must be practical and selfish. We must not put the interests of any group before the interests of ours. Rule number two says that we must take what we can and give up only what we must. Rule number three says that you take it from whomever you can, however you can, whenever you can. And if we're not ready to abide by these rules, then we have not reached the age of political maturity. And all of that talk at Gary about the new black politics is just an exercise in frustrated futility. With the power that exists in black America today, if we go to the well this year in November and come back with our buckets empty, then we have no one to blame but ourselves. We must realize that we have real power. We have the balance of power in many instances and the power to negate in many others. And this is power. What happened in Cleveland recently was not by accident. We have been saying for some time now that if Democrats in the urban areas refuse to share power with blacks, that they too will have none. And we see that for the first time in 30 years, a Republican has been elected mayor of the city of Cleveland. Now let's take a close look at the results of that election. The Republican ran first, the black ran second, and the Democratic candidate ran a poor third. Without the support of blacks, the Democratic Party would be in shambles throughout this country. Now tell me, who needs who? If they're willing to lose all that they have rather than share some of it with us, then they must make that decision. But let's keep in mind that white people know rule number two better than we do. And they're not going to give up all of that power just to keep us from getting a little of it. Now, on a national scale, I believe that a black political revolution has arrived. What happened at Gary, Indiana last week has opened up a new range of options for black people. The vehicle has now been set up that will force the Democratic Party to stop acting as if the black vote is automatically in its column, and it should encourage the Republican Party to actively seek black voter support, and it definitely has the potential of a major new national political party. I'd like to say that at one time, our politics was based on the theory of appeasing the white majority. Tonight, I'm proud to declare that the old politics of accommodation has been replaced by the new black politics of confrontation. I'm proud to say also that those leading the new politics are the young, the articulate, the dedicated. Those who possess a deep sense of personal commitment to the concept of justice and equality at any cost. Yes, there's a new breed of blacks in politics who are demanding a reevaluation of that old concept that what's good for the nation is good for minorities. We now couch our thinking in the fundamental concept that what's good for minorities is also good for this country. This position necessitates the development of a new political philosophy. Blacks must start with the premise that we have no permanent friends, no permanent enemies, just permanent interests. We must take what we can and give up what we must. We must learn to use the art of retaliatory politics, reward our friends and punish our enemies. Now, a Washington reporter accused me the other day of being angry. And my answer to him was simply that any black man in the United States today who is not angry is either stupid or crazy. I contend that we're angry. We're angry because a racist can sit in the White House and because pseudo-liberals can rationalize about the denial of rights to black people. We're angry because we have a national leadership which refuses to respond to the needs and aspirations of our people. We're angry because we have a cashew in the White House who can appoint a racist to the Supreme Court and call him a strict constructionist, who can support racial discrimination in housing by claiming to be in favor of economic discrimination. We're angry because that same pecan in the White House can talk about extending the right to vote to every citizen in the country and then propose that we move federal voting registrars from Mississippi to Utah. If I sound bitter, it's because I am bitter. I'm speaking tonight as a black man who just happens to be a Democrat. I'm bitter because I stand here tonight a descendant of people who have struggled for 200 years and who are still seeking full citizenship, still striving to become a part of the body politic. I'm extremely bitter because the leading candidate in my party, the Democratic Party, can tell us that this nation is not ready for a black man to be the vice president. Now, can you imagine? Our ancestors arrived on these shores a century before his, and he has the gall to arbitrarily eliminate 25 million people from consideration as our party's standard bearer. Well, from the results of the primary in Florida yesterday, it seems like he could use a purple, green, or pink vice presidential running mate. And I know that many people who don't understand what black people are talking about continue to point to us and say, you're making progress. I have a lot of people to tell me that times are changing. Some even point to me and say that my election as the first black congressman from Missouri is evidence of progress. Of course, I would have to say that being the first black anything in the year of 1972 is not an achievement or a verification of opportunity, it's a tragedy. And in my case, it inherently implies that hundreds of blacks before me have been denied the right to serve in Congress, and that hundreds of thousands of blacks have been denied legitimate representation. I think black America is really angry. We're angry because we're suffering the effects of a sinister, repressive, sick society. Incredible, isn't it, that the suggestion is still offered to us seriously and repeatedly that if black Americans will only be patient, this nation will finally surrender the rights and liberties due us. White Americans have taught us that they will admire in us, seek from us, take advantage of our patient endurance of injustice. We have witnessed that America's Christian image is as hypocritical as her constitutional guarantees. I ask, where is the conscience of America? Americans are incensed now because police stations and draft boards and universities are being bombed. But does this demonstrate a national American conscience? If so, where was that conscience during the 50s and the 60s when synagogues and black churches were being bombed at the same rate? How many Americans demanded then that we make it a capital offense to transport explosives across state lines to commit acts of violence? Our Congress recently passed a law making it a federal crime to cross a state line for the purpose of inciting a riot. That law was passed only in response to complaints that Stokely and Rapp and the Panthers were crossing state lines to incite riots. But where was America's concern and conscience when General Walker crossed over from Texas into the state of Mississippi for the purpose of inciting a riot at the campus of Oxford, and hundreds of thousands of dollars of property was destroyed, and people were killed at the University of Mississippi? But not one bill was introduced in Congress to prohibit that kind of activity. Where was the conscience of America then? The traffic of dope has alarmed this nation in recent years. We're not concerned because drug abuse is a very frightening, dangerous assault on our citizens. We're only concerned because the traffic of narcotics presents an imminent danger to white suburban America. Narcotics have been flowing into the ghettos of this country for 50 years. For 50 years, it's been destroying the lives and homes of black people. Where was the conscience of America then? I'll tell you, it's been in the same mothballs where it hid when black men and women were being lynched, where it was when black churches were being bombed, or where it was when black students were being killed because they wanted to get a cup of coffee at a lunch counter. where it was when black kindergarten boys and girls were being beaten with chains and bats by white adults, where it was when the pigs ripped off Fred Hampton in Chicago. That's where America's conscience has been. I contend that white America has no conscience, and that any black man still appealing to the conscience of this country is either the most insane or most frustrated person on earth. America responds only to power, and we had better get some. Now let's talk a few minutes about what's wrong with our country. I guess I could make the shortest speech in history. I could tell you in three words basically what's wrong with America. It would be Nixon, Agnew, and Mitchell. Today our nation under the present leadership is in real danger of being destroyed. But the most menacing threat to our security is not from some external abstract communist conspiracy, as some would have you believe. History tells us that of the 25 most powerful nations in the world, 23 of them have been destroyed from within. And unless we accommodate the aspirations of a new concerned generation and move with dispatch to make substantial change, we too will tumble like the mighty empires of Rome and Greece. The man who promised in his inaugural address to bring us together has torn us asunder. He has aroused and encouraged the racial fears and prejudices of the bigots. He has pitted the rural areas against the cities, the rich against the poor, black against white, and young against old. He has failed to give the moral leadership necessary to guide our nation in times of crisis. History will record that in the darkest hour of our republic, when leadership requiring imagination, creativity, integrity, and sensitivity were needed, that the best we could produce was Richard Nixon. I contend that as long as we're faced with this administration, that we shall be called upon to do our part in continuing the American tradition of protest. We cannot be intimidated by the Agnews, the Mitchells, and the other screwballs who object to protest. This country was founded on protest and has thrived on protest. As a former black slave said over 100 years ago in 1848, and I quote, "Those who profess to favor freedom and yet deprecate agitation are men who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its waters. This struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, or it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. Find out just what people will submit to, and you have found out the exact amount of injustice and wrong which will be imposed upon them. And these will continue till they are resisted with either words or blows or both. The limits of tyrants are prescribed by the endurance of those whom they oppress." End of quote. Well, times haven't changed much since Fred Douglass made that proclamation. The country was divided then, and it's divided now. But divided as it is, black Americans must unite and must save this country if it's to be saved. Blacks have taken the lead in reordering the priorities of this nation. We have become by and large the major voice in the struggle for honesty, decency, and morality. For years, we as a people have suffered all of the degrading, oppressive, humiliating attacks that could be heaped upon us by a racist society. And the only thing that kept us going was our humanity, our love of people. Well, that's what America needs now more than anything else. And it seems that we're the only ones with an abundance of it. Love for our fellow man is what the Congressional Black Caucus is all about. The 13 black members of Congress find ourselves leading the fight, directing the struggle, articulating the problems of this society. No other group in Congress is addressing the major, important, significant questions of today as the Black Caucus. We're seeking honesty, sincerity, and above all, sensitivity in politics. Our politics represents the basic interests of the black, the brown, the red, the yellow, the deprived and the denied, the poor and the decent. The record speaks for itself. The fact is that the efforts of the caucus are causing fundamental changes in the attitudes and actions of many too long content to accept the status quo. Now, as I close this evening, I'd like to make a statement that in light of all the sufferings that we have in our country, I've got to get back to our president somehow or another. Our president told us after the first moonshot that man had lived his greatest day when he set foot on the moon. I think it's incredible that the president could speak for all of us. Congressman Lewis Stokes summed it up well when he said, and I quote, that something is drastically wrong when a nation can set foot on the moon and cannot put shoes on all of its citizens, end of quote. Yes, too many Americans must disagree with the president about our greatest day. Setting foot on the moon has not brought us one foot closer to brotherhood here on earth. Our greatest day will be when every American can work commensurate with his ability and training, when every child receives quality education regardless of his race or status in life, when every American can live in a decent home and in a decent neighborhood. America will not see its greatest day until black mothers no longer die in childbirth at a rate four times as great as white mothers, until black babies no longer die of rat bite at a rate eight times as great as white babies. We will see our greatest day when 40 million people in this country no longer go to bed hungry or undernourished, or when 9 million people no longer turn to dope or alcohol as an escape from frustration and despair. Our greatest day will be when we have cleared all of the slums, when Americans attacked injustice and prejudice with a determination to end both, when every American is proud of his manhood and his country. We will see our greatest day when we end the hypocrisy that exists in this so-called Christian nation. We will see our greatest day when we no longer expect a man to be born in a segregated hospital, reared in a segregated neighborhood, educated in a segregated school, relegated to a segregated position of employment, married in a segregated church, die and be buried by a segregated undertaker in a segregated cemetery, and then expect him to wake up in an integrated heaven. It will not happen.
Congressman Clay will now entertain questions from the audience, and let me remind you again that the reception will be at ISR following the question and answer period.
Well, I'd like to preface my answer by saying at one time I believed everything I read in the white press. Today I believe nothing I read in the white press. I think that there were some significant accomplishments at Gary. I think the mere fact that we had people from 50 states, black people from 50 states, to meet in Gary to sit down and work on an agenda, a black national agenda, is significant and meaningful in itself. Nobody expected it to be perfect harmony. But I would say that there was no more or no less confusion, frustration, despair in Gary than there was in Chicago at the Democratic National Convention in 68. And certainly not nearly as much as it's going to be in Miami this year at the Democratic National Convention. I think that the press traditionally has either failed to report on news relative to the black community, or has miserably distorted or blown out of proportion what has taken place in Black America. For that reason, I never believe what I read in the New York Times, as liberal as it's supposed to be, with its little slogan, "All the news is fit to print." I don't believe very much that I read in these papers. I think that some real meaningful things took place in Gary. I think the vehicle was set up to start a third party in the event we're forced into that situation. I think the other thing is we set up a machinery that ought to give the Republican Party some hope that there are votes out here in this black community if they will change some of their positions and some of their programs. For too long now, we've been taken for granted by the Democratic Party, and it's bad because we haven't been able to exact any concessions from them. But the mood and the tenor of black America today is that if we aren't going to get something, anything worthwhile from the Democratic Party, we'll let them white folks fight it out by themselves. We'll either stay at home or start our own party. Yes. In terms of redistricting, yes, we haven't dealt with it as of yet. We're in the process of meeting with attorneys from various organizations, NAACP, the Urban Coalition, law professors, black law professors. We're preparing a suit to be filed, which will encompass a number of the districts where we feel gerrymandering has prevented blacks from getting representation. Suit has not been filed. We're in the process of filing it. I don't think it will have any effect on the elections this year. But the districts that were drawn this year are supposed to last for 10 years. I might say that there was a concerted action, and in my opinion, a conspiracy nationwide, to diminish the number of black congressmen. At least 10 of the 13 of us had terrific fights in trying to maintain our present districts or maintain a district where a black could be elected from. In several instances, we had to go to court. I just won my battle last week. I had to go to court to win it. Congressman Stokes had a terrific problem winning his, Perrin Mitchell and George Collins. Ron Dellums and Gus Hawkins' district still have not been settled. So I think there is a nationwide conspiracy to eliminate or to diminish the number that we presently have and to make sure that no new ones are created, no new black districts are created. Yes. Well, immediately after he got back, the ITT broke, and I don't think he got maximum coverage about his China trip. He wants to be first in many things. Unfortunately, he hasn't made his first trip to a ghetto in this country. He hasn't seen the deprivation and the suffering that exists in certain areas of our country. I wish he had spent a little time in Huff or Harlem or Fillmore rather than in Peking and some of these other places that I can't even pronounce. but I don't think it's going to have that much of an effect. You see, the one key, and again, I say don't believe what you read in the newspapers about Nixon being unbeatable. The one key to this election is as long as that unemployment rate stays at 6%, Nixon is in trouble politically. If it gets down to 4%, he's going to be reelected because they're talking about black people who are out of work. But once it goes over 4%, they're talking about white people who are out of work. And I want you to know something about Indians, whites, and blacks. Now, you know, they say an Indian never forgets his enemy. And they say a white man always remembers his friends. Sometimes they say we don't remember a damn thing. But them white people are going to remember that it's Nixon who put them out of work. And if that figure stays at 6%, Nixon is not going to get back in. I can assure you of that. Because we're talking about millions of whites who are unemployed. And they could care less about all of his anti-busing stands and his appointing racists to the Supreme Court and all of that other jazz. If they're not bringing that money home, Nixon is their enemy. And they know retaliatory politics. They're going to retaliate on election day. So, you know, it may be a callous thing to say, but let's hope the unemployment rate gets up to 8%. Yes.
Do you think that James Meredith, who is going to run for the United States Senate, I guess, on the Republican ticket in Mississippi, will be able to do better than the gentleman that ran for governor of Mississippi in view of the, voting registration and voting problems?
You mean Evers? You mean will do better than Evers did?
Yeah, right.
Well, you know, at the time that Meredith was trying to enter the University of Mississippi, there was a serious attempt made to confine him to a mental institution. With him filing on a Republican ticket in the state of Mississippi, perhaps they ought to start that procedure again. you know, that's another part of what I was talking about. We've got to stop playing games with black people politically. And Meredith played games in New York, and now he's down in Mississippi playing some more games. Meredith won't even be heard of on election day. Yes.
How do you assess or interpret the virtual lack of black youth political groups and big institutions, and especially in predominantly black small institutions of the South, if we want the so-called political power, political hegemony, to use the era of power?
The lack of black youth participation?
Right.
Well, I think that political participation necessitates a sort of an educational process. And I think that more and more young blacks are becoming educated to the value of the political process. I would think that our percentage of involvement at the young age is approximately the same as the national percentage is. And our involvement is going to increase this year. The involvement of poor whites and blacks will be much more substantial during a presidential year than it was last year when they first started keeping those records. But back in our district, I know the young blacks and the poor whites are coming out in vast numbers to register, because traditionally this has been the time when we felt we could have some impact and could make some impressions on elections. So I think that those results that we're reading about, the low registration of blacks, young blacks, isn't telling the true picture. The ones that will be coming out now will show a marked increase in young black registration. Yes.
Talk about the less sophisticated in his approach to, you know, instead of saying, I'm going to appoint a strict instructionist to the Supreme Court, I'm going to get my good old racist friend down here. You know, if he gets wide open like he used to do in years past, do you see this danger of this politics and confrontation, the return to this open warfare, or do you think that we should stay within this permanent political interest type of concept?
No, I don't. I don't really think that Nixon could do any more to us if he were openly advocating racism. I think the effects are virtually the same. I'm in favor of having the machinery there for a third party as a threat, as a hammer, in the event that that the Democratic Party or the Republican Party are not responsive to what we consider to be our needs and our interests, then we ought to be in a position to try and affect some kind of change or make some kind of impression or have some impact. Third party doesn't necessarily mean it has to be nationally, you see. In some areas, it would be to our advantage to have a third party movement, particularly in a situation where blacks are close to a majority, if we're at 35 or 40%, and you have a divided white community, it would be to our advantage to set up a third party apparatus and run independent candidates. And if by some chance the warring whites can't get together, mathematically you should be able to win. So, you know, just setting up the apparatus doesn't mean that you have to make it a national thing all at once. You might decide in certain areas. And you've got to remember that in 179 congressional districts, that we've got blacks constitute 10% or better in 179 congressional districts, and in about 40 congressional districts, we constitute 35% or better, which means if we ever catch them in a situation where they're warring in a district where we have 35%, we ought to be able to win on the independent ticket.